This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time. Jane Riley grew up in New Zealand, married an Englishman, and lives in Sydney, Australia. She has a degree in French and English literature and has worked in public relations, television publicity, and publishing. For more than 20 years, she freelanced as a writer and editor before launching an online e-commerce business and blog, interviewing makers and creators. Her debut novel, The Likely Resolutions of Oliver Clock, was won in an auction by Amazon Publishing and was a top five Kindle bestseller in the UK and the US. Her second novel, Geraldine Verne's Red Suitcase, was released in June 2021. Jane, let's start at the very start. Have you always been a writer?
So, yes, I would say I've always been a writer, in the fact that I've just always loved words and stories right from when I can remember. When I was six, I was writing poems, dreadful things probably, and putting them in booklets and drawing pictures next to them and that sort of thing. So I always knew I loved words. My parents were very big into not writing. Neither of them were writers, but my father was very good at telling bedtime stories and making them up. I think he used to think he was sort of Spike Milligan or something and would write, absurd, silly things, lots of limericks. And, he still does that to this day. So
that's such a great gift. I remember my kids saying when they wanted stories, they wanted a story from the head, as in not a book. And it's a burden, but he was obviously very good at it.
He loved it. He'd rather do that, I think, than actually read from a real book, which he did as well. And, books were, we always used to go to the library. I think Friday night was a sort of became a library night for a while. I got books as presents, Christmas, birthdays. So that, I think, was a sort of a subconscious influence or conscious influence, maybe. I don't know. And, yeah. Oh, actually, a funny thing. Earlier in the year, I was helping my parents move into a retirement village. And unbeknownst to me, Mum had kept quite a lot of my primary school exercise books. Why, I don't know. But it was very telling. So there was one I was flicking through and, have little tests. And I think I was about 7 or 8. And one of them, I got 20 out of 20 for spelling. The maths one, 6 out of 20.
So that basically was set from the start.
Yeah.
And do you remember the first thing that you ever had published?
So, yes. So with all this sort of love of words and writing, I had thought I wanted to be a journalist or some sort of writer. I definitely didn't think writing books, although I think I did think writing books would be great, but it wasn't something I thought was, a proper job, that usual, or they had no one to look to who had done that, in my life. So I thought I wanted to, say, write for newspapers or magazines. And when I was 16, I started doing a little bit of that. And I got my first thing published in what was then the Auckland Star when I was growing up in New Zealand. I think it was on flea markets and car boot sales.
Like a proper article?
Yeah, like a proper article.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah. In fact, I think I might have even taken, did I take the photo? Oh, no, maybe not. I can't remember. It was about the characters who buy from car boot sales and flea markets and the people who sell. So even then, I think I was interested in character with that. And this is me looking at it in hindsight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a fairly precocious thing to do as a 16-year-old. Like, that's really young to...
It was, and I'm impressive. Very much an introvert and was very, very shy and quiet then. So, yes, I don't know where the idea to just talk to strangers and ask them why they're doing what they're doing came from. But, I wanted the story. I was interested in the story. And I found it easier asking people questions rather than talking about myself. So I would rather be sitting right now in your position than where I am now. And then from there, actually, then the year later, in my final year of school, the New Zealand Herald was looking for, well, actually, the film critic at the time thought it would be better or be great to have a younger person do some of the film reviews for movies aimed at younger people. He was sick and tired of sort of doing them and feeling like he wasn't really the target market. So they sort of put a call out, and somehow my English teacher at the time heard about it and said to me, why don't you, you know, go and see a movie, write a review. I mean, I'd never done anything like that before. And so I did. I think I did two reviews. I definitely did one. And they really liked it and said, great, yes, would love you to do it. And then unfortunately, the head sort of higher up the management level just said, no, we don't need some to pay someone else to do it. Sorry, mate, to the original film cricket, you have to do it.
Crushing.
So I was really gutted about that. Yeah, that would have been a great little sideline.
Oh, that would have been a great side gig. Free movie tickets and writing is a pretty good combination. Well, we'll flash forward a couple of years. We know that The Likely Resolutions of Oliver Clock came out in 2019. Was that the first full-length manuscript that you'd ever attempted?
No. So I'm one of these people who have a few in the bottom drawer. So when I first decided that I really wanted to give writing a novel, you know, the idea of writing a novel a go, was when I had my first child. So 22 years ago. It was a while ago.
I feel like that's a transition point in life, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, one, you know, I had stopped work for a period, for a bit, although I did go back part-time, but certainly when she was first born, I wasn't working. And I was just getting a bit bored, to be honest. With all due respect to looking after a baby, I wasn't feeling very mentally stimulated. And she was a brilliant sleeper. So I felt more inclined to do some writing than do the ironing, for instance, when she was, when she was sleeping during the day.
Understand that compulsion.
Yeah. So that's what I did. So I thought, okay, this is my goal. Let's see if I can write a full-length manuscript, which I did. And then I think I submitted it out to a few places, got some rejections, got a placing in a very small award thing that doesn't exist anymore. But so enough, I think, really, for me to think, oh, okay, perhaps I can do this. It wasn't right, that one. Let's do something else. So then I eventually sort of fiddled around with another one. I mean, both times not knowing what I was doing at all, having done no courses, no nothing, and also, you know, then I had another child and then was doing more work. As you know, it's, you know, trying to juggle it all. It became sort of put on the back burner a little bit. In hindsight, I can see now that I wasn't really spending enough time on the editing of it. It was easy. I found it easy enough to write a full-length manuscript, but I really wasn't. I thought, oh, that's done now, isn't it? And thought, oh, I could send it out. And if you get one rejection, oh, it's not right, so I'll just start another one instead of reworking what I already had. I was also playing around with things. So the first one was a bit of a comedy. The second one was a thriller. But then I don't really read that many thrillers, and I freak myself out writing scary things.
Probably not the yeah.
This isn't a good avenue to go down. And then I tried, you know, something else. And then it was in about 10, 11 years ago when the first Faber Academy Ellen and Unwin writing novel course was launched, that I thought, you know what, I need to get some proper sort of tuition, if you like, and learn about the craft. So I applied to that and, yeah, got in. And that was the changing point.
And was that an Australian, is that only an Australian-based course?
No, so the Faber Academy is actually London-based.
Oh, right.
They were running it over there, and I guess Ellen and Unwin must have a connection with them. I'm not sure how that sort of happened. So Ellen and Unwin runs it, but it's called the Faber Academy. So they started in Sydney, and I believe now, you know, it's in Melbourne now as well.
I see.
Yeah.
And so
that was with Kerry, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, so when you start doing that, did you start with a concept or did you go in with one of your manuscripts. Yes.
So no, I did have a, so this was my fourth novel that I had was starting. And that's what I submitted as the work that I would sort of work on, if you like. So you had to submit writing that you'd done and, you know, a little bit about yourself, obviously. And that was what I worked on. Yeah.
And was that Oliver Clock?
No, so that wasn't Oliver Clock. That one has actually become book two, Geraldine Byrne's Red Suitcase, which has just come out, completely reworked. The main characters changed and so forth. But the essence of that book that I wrote in the course became my second published book. Yeah.
Right. So then how did all of this begin to unfold? Where did Oliver Clock begin?
Yeah, so I did the course. That was, my tutor was Catherine Heyman, who's absolutely brilliant and so enthusiastic. And I just learnt so much. And also just being around other like-minded writers. I didn't know anyone else who was writing like I was. It was this sort of little secret I had. Not really a secret, but, you know, something I didn't really talk about with anybody. So that was great as well, and getting other people's feedback. So within the book that I wrote in the course, the idea was that we would have something more or less, you know, ready to go out to submission, you know, if we wanted to. So I did that.
And this is across a 12-month period. Is that how Faber works?
No, this was 6 months.
Okay.
It was every week. So every Tuesday night for 6 months, and then one full day Saturday once a month.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I did send it out, and I got some quite lovely feedback, but again, you know, no publishing deal or anything like that. And then I remember actually saying to my husband, oh, you know what, I don't know if I write anymore. It's just, you know, it takes up so much time, and I get a bit obsessed about it, and I thought, you know what, I'll give it a break. And I was also starting up an online business, which was something I hadn't done before. And that was all new, had a business partner and so forth. But then I happened to read an article, one of those profile pieces in the Herald, you know, where the journalist has lunch with someone and talk about it. And it was an interview with a man who was the Australian Funeral Directors Association president, and whose family ran funeral homes. And I just got me thinking, what sort of life does a funeral director have? Who are they? You never bump into a funeral director or meet someone at a party, do you? Well, I certainly hadn't. Unless you're at a funeral, you pretty much never meet someone who works in the funeral industry. And for some reason, that got my imagination going. And then I remember saying to my husband, I think I'm going to be writing another novel. And that became Oliver Clock.
Right. And so what did the actual writing process look like? Did you interview any funeral directors?
I did about two-thirds of the way through,
yep.
Which was maybe a bit back to front. But so I was writing it. The whole process of writing the book took about 4 years. So while I was running my other business, I'd do it. I generally would sort of do it between 4 and 6. My girls were, you know, were at high school and off their homework studying, and that was just seemed quite a good time. It seemed to work. And then towards the end of that process, I actually used Catherine Heyman's sort of mentoring services, if you like, for a couple of months. She just helped me polish it off at the end. And also was in a so by that time I was in a writing group, just a small writing group, which was a spin-off from the Faber course.
I was going to say, one of the outcomes, best parts of Faber must be to meet weekly for 6 months. You must build great relationships with people.
Yes.
You would
yes.
have a,
well,
a
and
built-in
more bizarrely,
community.
One of the other women who was in my class, we had mutual friends, we realised, and now she's a really, really good friend and live in the same suburb. It was quite bizarre. So that was why we decided, let's start a little writing group, and we met up and brainstormed ideas and, you know, as they work, which was really good.
So yeah. you finished the manuscript, you have help from Catherine Heyman along the way. What did you do next?
So then when Catherine sort of said, oh, actually within in that process of working with Catherine, we're very nearly near the end, and she said, actually, have you thought of writing this in the first person? Because had been writing it in the third person. And I went, no, actually. And she went, it could work, you know. So, and I went, oh, my God.
Wow.
Then I thought, okay, why don't I'll rewrite the first chapter in first person. And then I sort of showed my writing group, and everyone thought, oh, actually, yeah, it probably does work quite well. But I thought, okay, I'll do another couple of chapters. And then it seemed to be the general consensus was first person. So I then literally, and I didn't just, you know, search and replace with the I physically retyped it. I printed out the original and then retyped it, changing it to first person.
But so what
actually, I was going to say, that's a really good editing process.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't just changing the pronouns, I was also fixing things up along the way, or adding a sentence or taking one out, and just it seemed to flow. I would not necessarily recommend it for everything, but it, even though it was very time consuming, it was actually quite a good exercise.
It's interesting. I think I never really thought that was a big decision, first person, third person, that kind of thing. No. But I know with my second book, I have labored over the decision between first and third. For you, what do you think the first person perspective added?
Well, I really got into his head more. I felt like I was him, if you like. And, you know, after 4 years with a character, you would hope you sort of know them relatively well. But because the whole book was from his, it was third person close anyway. It was very much his story. It was just so much easier to get into him more, I guess.
Oh, interesting. So you go through the laborious but beneficial process of transferring it into first person. Then what did you do?
So then Catherine's suggestion, which was a really good one, she said, I think you're ready to send it out. What I recommend you do is, you know, find a few books that you think yours would sit alongside on a bookshelf. Read the acknowledgements, because everyone, you know, they don't thank just a company or an agency. It's an actual person. So you need to find the right person within the right agency or publishing house who might be interested in what you've done.
That is a great tip.
Which was really good.
Good tip.
So I did that, then realised the five books that I'd picked were all UK writers. And I thought, oh, well, hang on, how's this going to work? And then I went, you know what? They can only say no. You know, I've already experienced rejections. It's fine. I'm going to target UK agents. I just thought, let's be bold. So I spent probably a good month researching UK agents, UK publishers, then Australian agents, Australian publishers. So I sort of had a short list and a long list for both. And then went, you know what, I'll just start sending it out. What's the worst that can happen? I hear nothing, or they say no, you know. So obviously you didn't send it to everybody all at once. I picked five agents in both countries, even though you're not supposed to even send it to multiple people at the same time. I really wasn't expecting to get any response, to be honest. But after the first week, I had a really lovely email from the woman who ended up becoming my agent, who was one of the UK agents. She said something, I made her laugh in the first 10 pages or something, which was just, if nothing else had happened, that was really, that was brilliant. It was really nice to have, you know, something so positive. And so she said, can you send me the rest of the manuscript? And then a week after that, she came back and said, I'm 2/3 of the way through and I'm still enjoying it. So it was like sort of little teasers.
Oh, that's so good.
And then I thought, oh, do I tell people now that someone's, you know, reading it? When do I, I'd be better not, you know, what's the word, tempt fate. So, and then I think about another week after that, she said, can we have a chat on the phone? And ultimately she wanted to sign me up. So,
that was such a good moment.
It was amazing. Yeah, that was really good.
And so obviously she's based in the UK. What did she do? She sent it to publishers.
Yes. So first of all, she wanted to do a bit of an editing process.
Okay. Yep.
So we had, I don't know, 3 or 4 months maybe all up. She was very, very detailed, not just a loose how about X, Y, Z happens, but quite detailed ideas and working things through, particularly in the first three chapters, really, really wanting to nail it because, you know, as you know, people might only read one sentence and say, nah, no, we're not interested. So I worked through, you know, with that, with her. And then when, you know, she said it was ready to be sent out, then it was literally, you know, obviously her doing. I was just waiting to see if anything.
Refreshing your email, I'm sure.
So I have to say, because I was tossing up whether, you know, do you get an agent? Do you have a publisher? She has been amazing. And from the business side of things, it's really not, you know, my total forte, and she has clout. And there's certainly the UK industry, if you like, is so much bigger than here.
Yeah.
And really competitive, and people know what other people are doing, and there's word on the street. It all seems very sort of, this is subterfuge. I mean, maybe it's like that here, I don't know. But, you know, she's saying, oh, we can't. I'm just waiting a week because I've heard this other book that's a similar genre that's people are looking at that. So I'm just going to hold off. We don't want to compete. And, you know, it's all this sort of very, very strategic kind of stuff going on, which, you know, I think as lay people, we don't really know about.
Well, you see how an agent helps then, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that you are the first author that we've spoken to that's been published by Amazon or Lake Union. So when your agent sent the book out, they were obviously one of the publishers that they sent it to. Did you know what publishers the book was going to?
Yes. So I would get an update. Yes, for sure. See, I came up against a bit of a hurdle. Well, I suppose this can happen to lots of people you don't really know about. In that, talking of competition, there was another book coming out that came out just before mine. Sorry, when I say coming out, I mean being submitted to publishers, that was similar, not set in a funeral home, but to do with the administration of death. Again, meant to be a bit quirky and humorous. And certain publishers did turn mine down because they'd already looked at this one and were interested in that. So, you know, you can be pipped at the post by something like that. Nothing to do with your writing or the story or anything else, literally because someone else happened to have a similar idea or vaguely similar. Even this is actually quite a different book because I've read it. But, you know.
So it feels so personal, rejection, doesn't it? But there are so many, I think it's helpful to know there are so many other
factors. It's helpful to know, which is why I wanted to say that, because it is helpful to know. I think it is very easy to be devastated if someone says no, but there's so many factors why you might be turned down. Yeah.
And the book went to auction.
So the book went to auction, yes. Well, bizarrely, it actually ended up going to auction in Germany first, just timings. So I ended up actually getting a German publisher before the English language publisher thing finally happened. And that was a bit weird because I was actually out with my book club at the pub, and about 9:30, I think we were all sort of ready, you know, about to sort of wrap it up. And I don't know, 9:30, quarter to 10, my agent called and said, you've got a German publisher.
Oh, my Verlag God.
Have won. I'm like, oh, my God, this is so weird. And so one of my friends went, right, champagne. So we didn't.
The night went on.
We didn't leave the pub at 9:30.
Oh, incredible.
That was amazing. Mm.
And so when Lake Union won the rights, how did you find out about that? Was it in a pub, a phone call, or did you know that this auction was happening?
So, yes, so I knew that was happening. There'd been lots of to-ing and fro-ing. I'd get email updates overnight. I'd had a few calls with people on the phone, with various other publishers who were perhaps interested. I even had a call to New York with Penguin Random House. I spoke to one of the publishing ladies there, which, oh, that was so nerve-wracking. I felt like I was going for my first job interview all over again. Oh. And in the end, they turned that down. Oh, no, I don't know why. I don't really know all the ins and outs of why things, you know, don't happen. But yes, so it was a very exciting and sort of slightly stressful period. It was all out of your control. But again, Ariella, my agent, was brilliant.
And so what did it mean for publication? Because Amazon won, and correct me if I'm wrong, the English language rights for the book. So that's US, UK, Australia, I guess other places potentially. How does it work? Does it come out at the same time everywhere? What does it look like?
Yes, so it comes out at the same time in every market. So whether that's a paperback, ebook, audiobook, all comes out at the same time. Yeah.
And what did the post-publication period look like for you?
Well, I suppose kind of weird in that because I'm not really, I guess, considered an Australian author here, I'm not really part of the sort of thing here. Not a lot happened here. So I was doing publicity things I did was all in the UK because they're essentially a UK arm of Lake Union. So I was doing things remotely and or, you know, yes, via email. So it sort of felt as if, how's the word? I felt a bit removed from it. Yeah.
Did you have a launch?
So I did. I did have a launch party, yes, which was literally just before lockdown. It was at the end of February last year. So that was lucky that was able to go ahead. But, yeah. And it went out. It was obviously out in bookshops and things. But, yeah, then it was lockdown.
And you're in lockdown at the moment, I should say, to listeners. But having said that, Oliver Clock was a Kindle bestseller in the UK and the US. Massive achievement. Congratulations. How did you come to learn that the book was doing so well?
So we get monthly reports, if you like. So you can see how they're very open about showing you where the book sold, who's bought it. You can see someone's bought it in India. Bought an audio book in Canada, or and the figures every day for every month. So they're quite transparent like that, which is quite interesting. You can even sort of hone it down to the city.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's, and you know, I'm not really into necessarily geographical statistics, but if you were, there's a story in there somewhere.
And is the ebook side of things something that Amazon focuses on in particular, or not necessarily?
So I think Kindle is a big part of their offering for sure.
I read a lot on Kindle. There's a huge rabbit hole that you can fall down looking at Kindle and how it works and all the rest of it. One of the things that they offer is Kindle Unlimited, which is a subscription-based model for books. So some books are part of it, some books aren't. Was Oliver Clock's, was that something you considered? Or was that a point for discussion, whether it would be included or not included in that?
Yeah, I mean, they put forward their sort of marketing proposal, if you like, and that was part of it. As is Prime Reading is another one. Things as well. Yeah. So it wasn't really about me saying, do I want to be in it or not? Kind of how they work. Yeah. Yeah. And obviously there's different levels and.
Yeah. It's a whole world I don't know a lot about, but I encounter it as a reader.
It is huge. It is huge. As is audiobooks. As are audiobooks. I mean, I don't listen. I will admit, I've read one book on a Kindle.
Did you read on Kindle or Kindle app? Because I feel like there's a big...
Oh, no, I've only ever tried the Kindle. But I do like a real book, I'm afraid. Yeah. And same with audiobooks. I haven't actually listened to a full-length book on the audio. But, you know, I do have friends who do and say that it's amazing. So I think these days... You know, it doesn't really matter how you read in inverted commas your books. It's all the same content, as in, you know,
yes, that's
one
true.
Different version is the same content, and the more people who have access to that, I think, is brilliant.
It's a really good thing. I agree. Yeah. I remember going to the library, like as a kid, and wandering through the audiobook section, which was all tape-based when we would go on family holidays. So I'm glad there's a bigger selection these days, because it was pretty limited back then.
Yes, yes. Oh, I have to do a big shout-out, I don't know if I can, to the narrator for my second book, Geraldine Verne's Red Suitcase, and same with Oliver as well, but she's just such a lovely lady. She's a British actress, Rosalind Landor, who sounds like Julie Andrews. I don't know, did you ever watch the Bridgerton TV series?
I did.
So the narrator of that was actually Julie Andrews. I don't know if you knew
yes.
that.
Yes.
And she's got a brilliant voice. Anyway, this woman's voice sounds the same. And I just thought, wow, it's just a whole nother world listening to your book. Not yeah. that I've listened to the whole thing. I've only listened to about a page.
Yeah.
Because it seems weird when you've written it.
It's so weird, isn't it? But again, that would be an incredible voice to listen to.
Yes.
Jane, that's probably a good segue into your second novel, Geraldine Verne's Red Suitcase. How was the writing process for that different? I guess I'm probably more referring to the publication process, in the sense that you had developed the book through the Faber Academy.
Yes. Well, so the reason that became my second book was purely because when Ariella said, look, I want to, you know, submit Oliver to publishers, and she said, actually, it'd be quite good to show them a synopsis of a second book, because we'll try and get you a two-book deal. She said, have you got another book? But, you know, send me something in a week. And I went, okay. having a bit of a panic, thinking, oh, well, maybe the book that I wrote in the Faber Academy, maybe I could do something with that. So I literally whipped up the synopsis. I think I tweaked a few things and I changed the main character because he was a man, and that one, because Oliver Clock for the main character was a man, I thought, okay, we'll change it. This could be a female. And then literally sent that to her without actually properly considering I might have to sort of write the story again. And that's what happened. So that's how that came about. So they bought Oliver, if you like, bought the Geraldine Verne story along with Oliver. So apart from being able to do, you know, make a few tweaks, essentially that was the story that I was expected to write.
Feels like a good
And I was given a year.
Oh,
so it was hugely different process. It became quite pressurized, I suppose, in comparison.
And so Geraldine came out in June this year. As we said before, you're in Sydney. Were you in lockdown again?
Yes. So I pretty much wrote the first couple of drafts in lockdown.
Oh my God.
Which was quite weird, because Geraldine Verne's story at the beginning, she's, you know, grieving so much for her husband that she ends up becoming a bit reclusive and she doesn't want to go outside. So I was sort of writing a semi-lockdown situation. It was self-induced from her perspective, whilst I was in a lockdown situation, which was a bit weird. And I did get to a point where I thought, I've just got to get her out of the house. If I can't leave the house, at least
like you're writing your own future.
Exactly.
And so what did publication day look like for that?
Well, that was very low key, because it was literally a couple of days before we went into lockdown again. So I think the books had just gone into my local bookshop and they were, I think, going to do some, you know, promotion or whatever, but we're in lockdown now. So that was only a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, God.
So it's been a bit...
So it'd be nice to come out for many, many reasons.
It's been a bit low key, but that's all right. Obviously, overseas sales and that kind of thing, it hasn't affected. So, yeah.
Jane, we always like to get advice for other writers on this show. What pearls of wisdom do you have, either about the writing itself or the head game of being a writer?
Oh, yes, there's so many, I guess. I think from the writing perspective, one thing that's really, it sounds obvious, but now that I'm writing a third book at the moment and I'm really, really taking this on board, is asking yourself questions all the time. Why is this character doing X, Y, Z? Why are they saying what they're saying? Why have you got this scene, you know, where it is, and so forth? Every line asking a question, which I think at the beginning, way back when I wasn't really asking myself these questions. I was just writing because, hey, this sounds good, or this is a good idea to have happen in the story. And then afterwards, you know, someone might say, well, why are you doing that? And you, if you can't come up with an answer very quickly, then it needs to go, because it's not part of, it's not part of what you're writing or the core of what you want to say. I think that's a big one. As far as the head game of writing goes, I mean, I think you can be always full of self-doubt, but you have to really love the writing, love the act of writing, process of writing, and be able to take on board criticism, a bit like what we said with the rejections. Don't take it personally, and take on board what other people say, because there is a certain amount of teamwork involved, I think, to get something to publication. Yeah. And also be determined, or be, or persevere if you really want this to happen. I mean, I think I'm a great case in point.
I was about to say, a great dating from your daughter's birth. It's a, it pays off, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But then I just loved writing. It got to the point where I really was doing it because I enjoyed the writing process. And of course, getting something published was a really nice goal or something to work towards and to hope might happen. But even if that hadn't happened, I probably would still be pootling around, you know, after hours, making up some sort of story.
That's nice.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.